Hello, and welcome to this episode of By Bat Chats Books, where we chat to Tom Clark. Tom is a journalist, a contributing editor at Prospect, and a fellow at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and was previously a leading writer at The Guardian for 10 years. In his new book, Broke, Fixing Britain's Poverty Crisis, Tom assembles today's masters of social reportage to go deep into the communities so often ignored by politicians, introducing us to those at the hardest end of the poverty crisis. Tom's preceding publication, Hard Times, Inequality, Recession, Aftermath, displays the same mix of human stories and analysis that gives Broke such clout. Today we want to chat about some of the sobering stories at the heart of Broke, how poverty has changed in recent years, and which three people he would give the book to in order to effect change. Great to have you on this episode of Bite Bat Chats Books, Tom Clark. Thank you so much.
Great to be here now. Thank you.
And we're going to be talking about your book, Broke, Fixing Britain's Poverty Crisis, which is out at the end of the month. And it's his first question, really. What made you want to write this book in the first place?
Just before I answer, I do need to emphasise, although I'm the editor of the book, it is a team book. And we've got, you know, a range of fabulous journalists there, like Jennifer Williams from the FT, Danny Garavelli and Daniel Trilling. So it's a team book, not just my book. The point where the penny dropped that we needed to do something like this was in the spring of 2022, so pretty much a year ago. Yeah. When, you know, working as I do at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, you look at this battery of grim statistics coming out. We had the destitution report saying the number of families officially classed as destitute by this Harriet Watt study was kind of going up by two thirds or something between 2017 and 2019. If I've got those numbers right, that during the pre-pandemic decade, the number of people with malnutrition diagnosed in hospital was doubling. We saw the rough sleeping creeping up for many years ahead of the pandemic, then went down. And then just recently it shot back up. So you see this kind of battery of data coming in the whole time, but you also know that there's always a temptation to think lies, damn lies and statistics, and there'll be some statistics that are going in the other way, and it's kind of how do we really make sense of this? And as some of these numbers were coming in and the prices were starting to rise, the thing that really caught my eye was this elderly woman, I think she was 77, Elsie, yeah, who was on Good Morning Britain, the ITV show. She wasn't on in person. She'd rung up and spoke to some producer, and then the questions had been put to the presenters to pass on to Boris Johnson, who was then the Prime Minister. All the news at this point was still about his Downing Street lockdown parties. That was the only game in town. But suddenly the mood changed when Elsie said, what would you recommend, Prime Minister, that I should do at the moment? I spend my days going round on the local buses because they're warm and I don't have to turn the heating on at home and I only eat one meal a day. And Boris Johnson kind of, the normal bonhomie kind of disappeared, and he just sort of said, well, you know, thanks to this government's tough decisions that you've got a freedom pass and you can go on the bus as much as you like. And jaws dropped, and that clip was shared everywhere, and there were write-ups of it in the paper, and you thought, God, we've had all these awful statistics for such a long time now, but Elsie's cut through in a way that no statistics do. And you suddenly think of, you know, the line attributed or misattributed to Stalin, that the death of one person is a tragedy, but the death of a million is a statistic. And you think, actually, if we want, rather than argue the toss, and we can come on to that if you want, about the statistics of poverty, if we actually want to wake people up, we need to focus on the individual stories. And hence, getting these real masters of social reportage like Jennifer Williams, like Daniel Trilling, like Samira Shackle, and getting them into the communities to ask people what's going on at the sharp end. That was the idea.
To relate more to the actual problem in front of them rather than just a bungle of statistics. What would you say has been the catalyst for living standards in recent years or of late? That's brought stories like Elsie's to the fore.
There are answers that apply over different time periods. You know, there's the very short answer, which is that actually from just before the start of the Ukraine war, but certainly since the Ukraine war got going in earnest, we've had a very stiff increase in energy prices that everyone knows about now. And that's a huge squeeze on people whose cash incomes are low. We had the pandemic, which, although there was some emergency support during that, and it achieved enormous things, actually, we mustn't get all doom and gloom. Some things work, and giving people £20 a week extra and the furlough during the pandemic did work. But it did mean that better off people were saving on restaurant meals and holidays and all these kind of things and building up savings, and poorer people whose incomes were disrupted and found that sick pay is extremely low in this country or not always available. And so you ended up with people, you know, who'd got, you know, the most modest rainy day funds burning through them during the pandemic. And then going further back, of course, for years now, for something like six out of the, no, maybe it's seven of the last 10 years, the benefits have not gone up in line with prices. And so people have been slowly sinking below the breadline. Because if these benefits were ever, as they were at one point meant to be, pegged to the essentials of life, that they've ceased to be so by, you know, being frozen in year X or being capped at a 1% rise in year Y. And these things ratcheted and ratcheted up so that when these pandemic and the energy emergency hit, people were just had no spare room whatsoever. And then, you know, you can go further back with some of this stuff and say we're now reaping the whirlwind of policies that go back 40 or 50 years.
Yeah.
In terms of things like the 1980s deregulation of the housing market and the move to private rental. So more people are dependent on private rents, which can kind of gallop ahead of what they can afford to pay and where they can be booted out at short notice, which is what Jem Bartholomew writes very movingly about in the book. And of course, sort of slow pattern towards less unionized, flexible labor markets. And that's been a trend, you know, only modest interruption since the 70s. So, you know, you can answer that question. I'm sorry, it's a very long answer in a short way or a long way, but we can say, you know, right from 50 years of, you know, what in the jargon you might call a neoliberal economic model to 10 years of austerity to 1 or 2 years of pandemic and energy crunch. So there's short and long-term answers. And the real problem here is, of course, that they've all come together.
Definitely. And so poverty has been around forever, but at different rates, as you say. And so stories like this and the role of human stories can sort of sear the reality of hard times with imagination, as you say in the book. Would you say that there's been a new form of poverty that hasn't been recorded in the past in the 21st century? I'm thinking of sort of Francis Ryan's chapter on disability and sort of how the sort of demographic of Britain and the disabled and, as you just said, the working has changed.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, I mean, deliberately here, there's always arguments, or there used to be more arguments than there are now, you know, about relative poverty, as in falling behind everyone versus absolute poverty of going without proper shoes and shelter and food and so on. You hear that a bit less right now because, you know, although there's always arguments about statistics, and some of the statistics don't look so bad, the ones that the Chancellor pulled out for the budget just recently didn't look so bad, but you know, I think when it comes to that real hard end of destitution, the statistics do look really bad. And, you know, what destitution means, that is something that hasn't changed very much. And, you know, this is, you know, the gnaw of hunger and the kind of the sort of desperation of being too cold and the fear of where you're going to sleep that night. You know, these are perennial features of poverty, as indeed are the social exclusion. We've got a line from George Eliot's Middlemarch in the book about about how people are cut off from what they've held most dear when they're destitute because, you know, they're too ashamed to share the problem with those who would otherwise get them through it. And of course, that's what we found with a number of the case studies. They've got family, they've got friends who might have helped them, but they didn't want to tell them quite how tight things have got. So all of that is a perennial, but as you alluded to in your question, the groups of people who are experiencing poverty have changed. So, you know, whereas we hear from Javid, who's living in Leeds and was driven to attempt to take his own life by jumping in the River Aire, we hear from him at one point. He's a character that probably Charles Dickens wouldn't have recognised. You know, he's a bisexual who's on the run from Pakistan because people like him aren't looked after very well there, and so he wants to settle in the UK instead. But he's struggling with the immigration system. So he's not the kind of person who would pop up as a street urchin in Charles Dickens. And yet the experience that he talks about of, you know, there's no way of getting clean. It feels like everything around you is dirty. You have to rely on the rain sometimes to give yourself a bit of a wash, you know. So those things are the constant, the experience. But the groups, and people like Javid, are different from the groups who'd suffered in the past. Now, if we go back a long way from when the Elizabethan poor laws were put in place right through the works of Charles Booth and Seaborne Rowntree, the surveys of poverty in the Edwardian era, and right up to the instigation of the welfare state, the focus is on the elderly.
Mm.
The old are the poor. It's almost like they're the same poor. The same people who write about the poor, in inverted commas, also write about fixing the elderly problem. But now, and this is a tremendous success, you know, that like it's important these kind of books don't just like depress you, is that if we draw someone at random from the population and they're old, and we draw an elderly person at random from the population, it's more likely that the non-elderly person will be poor than the elderly person, right? So that is a huge historic achievement. And that's actually why some of the headline figures don't look as bad as you might think because of that massive progress, despite Elsie's case study and despite the problems with energy in the last year or two. The elderly are not the core problem here anymore. The groups where we're seeing extraordinary concentrations of hardship are migrants who are officially more or less denied any kind of safety net at all. So if you don't have any kind of safety net and you don't have any social safety net, you don't have any friends and relatives either, which is a position a lot of migrants in, then you are kind of back in Dickens land, you know, in terms of like the daily scramble for food. So there's that group. There is a group that's grown, having shrunk like at the start of the century, is now growing again, which is people with lots of children, because there is a problem with the benefit system, because we've now decided that we're going to treat children as a consumer good and say, if as a parent you've had three or four children, we're not giving you any money for that, which is fine if you want to punish the parent. But of course, what it means that we're doing is punishing the children who, like the sulky teenager, would be quite right to say, you know, I didn't ask to be born, and yet they're still suffering the consequences of this. And the third group that you alluded to is disabled people, and particularly single disabled people.
Yeah.
If you've got a couple in their sort of 50s and, you know, one or the other of them has got worn out by life, then at least the other one might still have an income and be able to ferry the other one around. Mm. But if you're on your own and you've got to bear all those extra costs of taxi receipts and wheelchair parts and all the rest of it, and your income is entirely dependent on benefits, and at least some of those benefits have been frozen in recent years, then you're in real trouble. Mm. And so, you know, when we looked at what we call very deep poverty, I mean, this is getting a bit technical and away from the spirit of the book in that it's about different poverty lines.
Mm.
But if instead of the normal poverty line, which is 60% of the typical income, we look at one at 40% of the typical income, we find a huge concentration of single disabled people. And then when the same individuals are asked how they're doing in terms of keeping up with the bills, keeping warm and keeping properly fed, then we find that they're an answer to those different questions between kind of 4 or 5 and 8 or 9 times more likely to be sort of destitute in terms of those basic measures. And then in terms of our reportage, Francis Ryan, meets characters who absolutely bring this to life. There's a woman, and, you know, this is one of 2 or 3 stories in the book that I will never forget, called Sandra, who is an extremely severe asthmatic. So she has to take very heavy steroids, which is the way to keep her breathing.
Mm.
And as a result of taking these heavy steroids, her bones have hollowed out. And so now she can't walk any distance without, like, either hurting or risking breaking the bones that have been hollowed out by the steroids. And yet, under one part of austerity, she was subject to what's called the bedroom tax. And they said that, you know, this extra room you've got that you say you need for your equipment and whatever, actually, we're not going to pay for an extra bedroom for you anymore. So her and her partner were moved out into a one-bedroom place as well. Her adult son came back. And as a result of that, he needed the bedroom. So Sandra, in her ill condition, her frail condition, I should say, was forced for a long period to sleep on the floor. And, not sleeping properly for years on end, combined with the underlying condition, meant that she had an asthma attack so severe that her heart stopped. So, you know, she was kind of heart dead for a few seconds, went into intensive care, recovered remarkably, but still on these drugs, still with these underlying vulnerabilities, was given a new house and had this air conditioning that would keep the air moving through her lungs on a warm day. And then suddenly the energy crunch hits and she can't on a warm day keep that air conditioning on. Yeah. So, you know, this is someone who we've already pushed as a society so hard that her heart has stopped at one point. And now we're telling her she can't afford, we're going to put her in a position where she can't afford the air conditioning she needs to keep the air moving through her lungs. So, you know, as Francis writes quite rightly in the chapter, it's not a cost of living crisis. It is a cost of staying alive crisis.
Mm. And so that's one of the system's worst gaps of where there's been no help. And you talk about sort of the trade-off between immediate fixes of the worst gaps and then the steady improvement in the adequacy of supporting this in the long term. It's a tricky balance to strike. And how do you recommend that the Treasury or the government navigate this?
So, I mean, there's the short-term answer and then there's the long-term answer.
Yeah.
Money is, I mean, it's a separate question, you know, how tight fiscal rules and arithmetic, and, you know, that's not what we're doing in this book, needs to be. But, you know, either we need to, one way or another, we need to find money to support people. And we know that this is a rich society and that there's a lot of money there. There's a lot of untaxed gains that people make on selling family houses. We've got a property tax system that is by design regressive with respect to house prices, so that, you know, that more expensive homes pay proportionately less.
Yeah.
We also tax capital gains less than we tax income, and so on and so on. So, you know, if we want to tap wealth, there is wealth that is there to be taxed, but that is going to be a very difficult thing to do because people with wealth are going to resist it. And so we need to make the argument. The argument, I think, starts by saying, let's repair the real holes in the social safety net. Now, there's been all kinds of different cuts and austerity measures. There's probably been 25 or 30 different measures. Mm. But I think the urgent thing is to restore the broken link between people's needs and people's eligibility. So as a principle, I think we need to make a stand against for example, like that two-child rule that says, unlike every other system of poor relief going back, you know, hundreds of years, we're not going to take account of how many mouths a family has to feed anymore.
Mm.
And we need to say, if you've got high rent, you know, then we'll like pay some account of the rent you're paying rather than just freezing it and pretending that shelter is a separate thing from the benefit system. Even if you did that, though, some of these benefits are just going to be too low. You know, that wouldn't cost the earth, what I'm talking about there in terms of fixing the worst holes. But over time, we need to ratchet some of these benefits up. And I say over time, I mean, obviously, I'd like to do it overnight if you could, but they've been squeezed down over time. And I think politically, the easiest way to do it will be by ratcheting them up over time. You know, that's going to take an argument because there's going to be tough choices. There's going to be choices about how much wealth to tax. Also, health and education and everything else is going to want it to share. People think, you know, rightly or wrongly, that defence needs a lot more money now. And so it's going to be a tight squeeze. But I think the argument needs to be that this is not just poverty relief, that the gap between people in the middle and people right at the bottom, as lots of the stories that we tell in the book illustrate, that line between the supported and the supplicants is getting blurry. And where that's helpful on the politics is we can say, you know, that like not just some benighted kind of minority might need the support of the welfare state at some point. Actually, most people might. Mm. And in fact, we can return to the argument made by John Hills of the LSE a few years ago. We went through and crunched like the work that the welfare state did and said, you know, most of what it does isn't just redistributing between the top or the middle and the bottom, it's redistributing for all of us across our lifetimes. And any of us might get unlucky with a disability, might get unlucky with a redundancy at some point. And so, I mean, as we make this hopeful kind of ratchet up in the benefit rates, which will have to be argued for tooth and nail in a tough spending climate, we need to be saying this is so that everyone in the society can live with a modicum of security that they otherwise wouldn't.
Mm. And we hope that this book falls into the hands of people with power to make change. And the Joseph Rowntree Foundation is distributing a copy to each MP. So hopefully they read it. But apart from MPs, if you could give a copy, three copies of the book to three people to affect change, who would you like the book to fall into their hands?
I am going to be absolutely shameless about this and just say I think we should give this to people who I think would make noise about it if it was up to me. You know, so like let's start with Marcus Rashford.
Okay, great.
A charming young man who, as well as a hero to many, who knows something about poverty given where he grew up himself, but has used his position to make a huge amount of noise about it and shown that he can move government policy and set the argument as he did on some of the issues around food.
Okay.
And again, why not just go for people who can make the maximum noise? The MPs have already got it, right? So we're now doing fantasy kind of list of readers. Why not go for, I don't know, Meghan Markle or Harry? Because, you know, they like to make a bit of trouble. I think there's some really interesting comparisons and really interesting books coming out at the moment about poverty in America. I think they'd be able to usefully highlight the transatlantic gap. They'd like to put a knee in Britain a little bit, which wouldn't be a bad thing. And of course, you know, I think that wealthy people, including them, unlike Marcus Rashford, who gives half of what he earns away, so it's kind of immune from this. I think wealthy people need to think about how wealthy and how lucky they are, because the solutions I'm talking about ultimately are going to involve tapping some of their money. So I put Meghan and perhaps onto Harry there as symbolic both of the noise they could make and of the fact that we do need a rich reading constituency to feel a bit uncomfortable. And finally, I mean, obviously I'm a journalist, so I'm a bit kind of liable to be blown around by the news. Without overdoing the football, let's go for Gary Lineker, who has made so much noise recently about the issue of refugees. You know, the absolute worst and most shocking poverty that we found in the book was in the chapter on people with no recourse to public funds because their paperwork isn't in order. The one that will stay with me is a woman called Mary in Leeds, who's been in the UK for 20 years. She's not a drug addict. This is a woman who kind of goes to church. You know, whether or not you think that matters, she's like, you know, she's what past generations would have called the deserving poor. She's on the run from political violence in Zimbabwe, has been for 20 years, but still hasn't got her paperwork in order. And so, you know, we leave her with absolutely nothing. We leave her begging. And in order to sleep, either she sneaks into St. James's Hospital and hangs out in the foyer, or she picks up a discarded ticket for what's called the mega bus, the cut price bus that goes from London to Leeds, and gets on that because it's warm and you can sleep there, and comes back and then has another day aimlessly wandering the streets of Leeds because we choose to allow her no alternative. And I think Gary Lineker is going to be my choice for someone to make some noise about the plight of people in that bind, given what he's done about migrants. And I should say that all the royalties from the book are going to Leeds Asylum Support Network, which is on Mary's case.
Amazing. Those are three great answers, Tom, and hopefully the book falls into their hands. Thank you so much for chatting about your new book you've edited, Broke, Fixing Britain's Poverty Crisis, out on the 30th of March. It's been a delight, and thank you again.
Thank you, Neil.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Bite Back podcast. Broke, Fixing Britain's Poverty Crisis, is out on the 30th of March. Head to the Bite Back website to use exclusive 20% off code BROKE20. And whilst you're there, dive into some other online Q&As with our authors. And do get in touch with us on Twitter with any questions or queries at BiteBackPub.